Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Jan Cooney, National Science Foundation Program Officer, award-winning research scientist. Jan shares her insights into increasing participation and attracting diversity into computing and STEM disciplines. Jan, you have a diverse background with many significant contributions. Thank you for sharing your deep experiences and insights with our audience.
Thanks, Stephen, for giving me the opportunity to do this interview. I've been looking forward to it.
Jan, you're just an amazing individual. So can you share a typical week and then month in your schedule, your activities, outcomes, and lessons learned?
Sure. I'm a program officer at the National Science Foundation, and so I spend some time every week administering the programs that I run. We do kind of obvious things. We receive proposals. We fund people to do projects based on these proposals. So they have to come in. We have to get them peer-reviewed. We make our decisions. And we have to process the awards. But often there's a lot that goes on before and after the proposals come in as well. So before, I try to promote the program so that we get the best possible set of proposals. I give talks at conferences and write articles for various publications that might reach potential proposers. I talk to people who are interested to make sure they understand the goals and constraints of the program and give them suggestions on where they can look for collaborators and other information. After the awards are made, I usually stay pretty involved. I'm really a hands-on program officer. I chat with a lot of the people who are running my awards on a regular basis, especially the larger ones. They have to submit annual reports that I review. I go on site visits, so I go out to actually where their locations and see what's happening. And occasionally they submit small requests for additional funding to react to new opportunities that come up, so I process those as well. But actually, that processing awards and kind of managing the program is just a small part of what I do. I'm trying to build a national community around the issues that my program's addressing. So we need to have more undergraduate and graduate degrees in computing, and my program in particular has an emphasis on students from the underrepresented groups, so women, persons with disabilities, and underrepresented minorities, which in computer science are African Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics. And those groups together make up 70% of our population. So they don't participate in computing, and if we have to up the numbers of computing, that's the obvious place to look for new people. So I'm trying to build a community of people who work on underrepresentation, issues of underrepresentation, and we have face-to-face meetings, but also we do that over electronic channels. I try to bring together people who can collaborate and compare notes, and we insist that people formally evaluate their work and produce papers on the results of that work so that we can know what works and what doesn't work, and generally try to align and leverage efforts. I also try and align our efforts with government agencies, foundations, and industries. So I talk to people from all of these communities in a typical week. So this week I met with a major foundation to talk about a new STEM initiative that they have. I had several conference calls with companies and another with a public-private partnership that's working with the state governor's office to reform education in across the whole state. I talk about their projects some. I talk about my projects, but the focus is always kind of moving ahead with a common agenda in STEM. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and computing is in that general mix of things. So this week I had several meetings with people working in schools because I work a lot trying to get computer science courses and material into curriculum in schools. And I worked with some local scientists and engineers who were trying to hook up with the schools. And we're hosting a big meeting this weekend for 300 people who are coming to LA to work on building collaborations and building solicitations, building proposals for the new solicitation. So I did some preparation for that meeting as well. And that's actually a pretty typical week. And those weeks are pretty much what I'd be doing most of the months of the year. But there's 3 months where I get a lot of proposals. So I can accept proposals at any time. But most of my proposals, probably 95% of them, come in on the second Wednesday in May. So that means that May, June, and July are totally focused on getting those proposals reviewed and processed.
Wow, I'm just amazed at all of that work and all of the kind of communities that you're linked with. You must be really energized by all of these activities.
I am, and the people that I work with in these communities are just the most amazing people. So if I ever have a low point in my job, I just go out and go to some more of these meetings and get completely re-energized. It's really fun.
I'm just curious, do you ever get a chance to go to the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair?
You know, I haven't, but I'm working a lot this year on a project called National Lab Day, and one of the things that we're doing is holding a bunch of STEM science events the first week in May, and the Intel Science Fair people will be here, so I'm hoping that I get to see a lot of them that week.
Well, I'm actually judging for the ACM and special awards at the Science Fair this year, so it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, computing has been underrepresented in science fairs for a long time. So one of the things I'm hoping to do is to give us more of a presence.
So what can you tell us about yourself that few know?
The only thing I can think of that few people realize, because I spend so much time talking and talking to people and groups of people, is that I'm really a shy person, and I don't like this at all. I don't like even talking on the phone. It's uncomfortable for me many times. So a high school teacher once told me that it doesn't really matter whether you're nervous or uncomfortable. It just matters that you don't show it. So I have spent a lot of time trying to hide the fact that I'm actually uncomfortable in many professional situations.
You know, you would never know it in this interview. So looking back over your amazing career, what were the biggest obstacles in your lifetime, and how did you overcome them?
Let's do this chronologically. So I'll start with, I think, one that is true for almost all girls, certainly all girls in my generation, who are interested in math and science, and that's that girls aren't supposed to be good at things like that. To kind of get the message that that's not a field for girls, that it's not a field that girls can succeed in. And so I think I internalized a lot of that while I was growing up and had a lot of issues around confidence, which I think is very limiting. It limits the opportunities that you have. It limits what you're willing to try and how high you're willing to aim. So I think that that has been a big obstacle, and I think it remains an obstacle for me and for many women. I'm hoping that that's not going to be true for women who are coming through the pipeline now. And I've worked recently with two fellows who've been working with me who are both young women who are incredibly confident and really competent, and it's a joy to see. So I think that kind of a lack of confidence has always been a problem. And the way that I've overcome that is I'm just really, really stubborn. So even if I think I can't succeed, once I'm on a path, I'm unwilling to move off that path. So I think that that has stood me well. And surprisingly, we once went around a group of very accomplished women who were in the room. There were 100 people there, 100 women, and asked them what the single characteristic they thought they had that made them successful. And an incredible number of them said they were stubborn. So I'm not alone.
I see. Perseverance, right?
Perseverance, yeah. Just, you know, refusing to give up, even if you think that it's probably hopeless. The second biggest challenge is also, again, one that I think a lot of women face, and that's having children and trying to get tenure at the same time. So my husband and I were both new professors at UMass, the University of Massachusetts, trying to get tenure. You have 7 years to get tenure, and so it's a pretty intense time in terms of your career. And at that same time, we adopted 3 older children. One of them was almost 7, one of them was almost 4, and the youngest one was 18 months. And so trying to juggle these children and these kind of intense periods in our career was fairly chaotic. Both of us were very involved as parents, and both of us were working really hard with the stress of tenure. So I think that was a really hard time, a challenge. And I'm not sure how we did it. We had lots of energy, maybe more energy than I have now. My 2 grandchildren visit me now for a week, and I'm totally exhausted and can't imagine how I ever did this full time. But I think that was a big challenge, and I think that's hard for a lot of people. There's a mismatch in the academic careers where the time that your children are youngest is generally overlaps with the time you're scrambling to get tenure. And then finally, my biggest challenge right now is to get people who could make a difference take the issues that I'm working on, which is getting more students, and particularly a more diverse group of students, into computing, to get those people who could make the difference to take it seriously. You know, I'd like schools to do a better job of teaching computing. That's true both at the university level and at the high school level. I'd like parents to be more supportive of kids. I think parents are giving kids the message right now that there are no jobs, and they're not encouraging kids to go major in computing. So we need to change that messaging, because there are a lot of jobs. And I'd like universities to go the extra mile to support a more diverse group of students. I'd like the media to give more accurate portrayals of what computing and IT professionals are like. So kind of a large group of players who I think could make a difference in these issues, and I've been working hard to get them to take it seriously and to invest in it.
You know, it almost sounds like you probably work with Lucia at NC WIT or Maria at Math for America.
I work with all these people, yes. I have had many conversations with both of them. I try and work with anybody who's remotely interested, and so I work with NCWIT. CRAW is another group that has done a lot of work for women in at kind of the research level, so undergraduate and graduate research. I've worked with the Anita Borg Institute. I've talked to Maria Kawe about Math for America. I've talked with Teach for America. Kind of try and hit everyone who can help in some part of the problem.
So what are some of the milestones in your life, and why would they be milestones?
Well, I think the first milestone was going to Princeton during its first year of coeducation. So I applied to Princeton and was shocked to find out that they didn't accept women. Shows how naive I was. I didn't know that at the time. So they sent back my application and said they weren't accepting women. And I was kind of surprised that there would be a major institution that didn't accept women. And a couple months later, they sent me another application and said, well, we've changed our mind. We're going to accept women this year. So I applied and got in. And it was really an interesting experience, not necessarily all entirely pleasant. But they only accepted 100 women. So there was a lot of attention and focus on the first 100, which did make me quite uncomfortable. But it let me see, I think, that I could function in situations where I was uncomfortable, that I, you know, it was okay to be nervous. And I could function in male-dominated environments, which I think was a very good lesson for someone who ended up in computing. It also gave me a real impetus for changing things, and it made me want to change the kind of male-dominated environment in computing. So I think it led eventually to a lot of the work that I've done on gender issues, those experiences. And I'm happy to report that Princeton has changed dramatically since I was there. So I think the issues that were there have largely been alleviated. The second milestone, I would say, was adopting older mixed-race children. It had really opened my eyes. I had lived a very privileged childhood, and I had gone to great schools and had had kind of every opportunity. So it really opened my eyes to the struggles that people who don't have all those opportunities are faced with. It's given me a much broader view of the world, and it's made me, I think, more open and much more of an activist at heart, although I think I had some of those tendencies all along.
Can you tell us more about your past work with the Anita Borg Institute for Women and Technology?
Sure. So I think issues of gender and computing are really important. Girls represent just 17% of the advanced placement exams in computing. That's really low. That's the lowest representation of females in all the other disciplines. So physics does much better, for example. If you look at the college level, women earned only 18% of the college degrees. Back in 1985, they were earning 37% of them. So there's been a huge drop-off. We're the only field of all of the sciences that are losing women. Some of the sciences don't have a lot of women, like physics and engineering, but they're kind of holding their own. We're the only field where the representation is plummeting. Women hold more than half of all the professional occupations in the U.S., but only 24% of them in computing. So I think there's a huge amount of work to do on gender issues in computing, especially at a time where we're being told by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that we're underproducing computer scientists significantly. So I started working with ABI, actually, before it was even ABI. Gender has always been kind of an important issue to me, and I had been working with the CRA Subcommittee on the Status of Women in Computing, and I met Telly Whitney and Anita Borg. So Anita Borg, the institute was named after her, and she and Telly got it started. And when at the very beginning, I would have to say I was incredibly skeptical of their plans. We had a small committee that was working on gender issues, but the idea that they would start this conference that was just for women in technology and that they would start an institute focused on it seemed to me to be just unrealistic and far-fetched, and I couldn't believe that there was a demand for it or that it would be sustainable. But Anita and Telly are so enthusiastic, and they were so energized by this idea that it was kind of impossible to stay on the outside of it. You know, they pulled in even their biggest skeptics, and once they got rolling, they were kind of unstoppable. So the conference and the institute that they've started now have both grown enormously, have lasted through the years. Telly has taken over the leadership of that after Anita's death, and it's just become a really awesome presence and very key in terms of bringing women into computing and probably the key institution in terms of bringing women at the professional level into computing.
What are the goals of the National Center for Women in Technology?
NCWIT. So NCWIT aims to change the face of computing, and I was also involved in the very early discussions of NCWIT. They believe that in a diverse society and a global economy, gender diversity is what's going to bring us larger and more competitive workforces, and that in terms of innovation, it's going to be diverse workforces that enable us to design technology that's broad and creative as the people it serves. And so it's not just an issue of being fair to girls and giving them opportunities. It's an issue of what kind of a workforce are we going to be able to field, and how creative and how innovative is that workforce going to be. So NCWIT works very closely with ABI, and they have a number of partners. In fact, NCWIT works with just about every organization that is working in the same field. So they're very well, they have lots of partners, lots of collaborators. They work with girls at the K-12 level, at the college age students. They look at faculty, they look at university departments, and they look at professionals and their employers. So they have a lot going on. They have four big components, four alliances. They have a K-12 alliance, and that looks at both in and out of school issues. Academia, they look have an academic alliance, and that looks at universities and colleges and what's going on there, what kind of climate are we giving to women, what kind of support are we giving to women. And they have an industrial alliance that looks at companies, what's going on there, how can companies contribute. And they have another alliance for social scientists that look at the research around these issues and kind of detecting best practices and figuring out what works and what doesn't work. So NCWIT really comes, and their partners really come at issue of underrepresentation of women in computing from all directions. They've become a clearinghouse for information, best practices, programs in a box. So I think that much of the work that's happening in gender issues in computing either comes through or contributes to the activities of NCWIT. They are kind of instrumental in rallying the community and keeping the issues front and center.
You know, can you provide background and then tell us more about your past work with the Grace Hopper Conference?
Sure. Telly and Anita came to us with the idea of this Grace Hopper Conference, came to the CRA committee I was on a long time ago, and I was totally skeptical. I could not imagine why I would go to a conference of all women. You have to understand that this was at a time where when you went to a conference, there were less than 10% women at most conferences, and so the idea that you would go to a conference of all women just seemed really strange. And why would I do that? Why wouldn't I go to a technical conference in my area? Why would I spend my money and my time to go to this? So I was totally skeptical of this. Somehow I got on the program in some panel or something in the first one, though, so I went to it. And I was just completely blown away. The energy and the enthusiasm and the excitement in this room, which at that time was just a couple hundred people, a couple hundred women, it was just overwhelming. And the networking that went on, the connections that people made, the support that you got, this feeling that you weren't, that you actually belonged in this field, that you weren't alone in the field, that there were lots of other women who had similar interests to you. And it was just, it was amazing. So I've been to almost every one of them since then. And one year I was the program chair, which meant that I was in charge of getting all of the activities that went on during the conference. It's a long conference. It lasts for just about 3 days. And we have, in many cases, seven tracks going. So there are seven different talks or workshops or other activities that are happening all the time. So filling up that program was challenging but fun. And in the end, despite my doubts going into it, we had so many things that were great going on that just fitting them all in was the problem, not finding enough of them. And then another year I was the general chair. So I've been very involved in those conferences. And they continue to grow. The last one was close to 2,000 people. We hold them every year now. And they're still overwhelming. You walk into this room of close to 2,000 women, and the energy is just palpable. There are great talks that you hear on research. There's lots of career development workshops and talks for students and young professionals. There's career development opportunities even for us kind of old-timers. There's lots and lots of networking. So it's a place that gives women the message that they belong in the field and that it's their place too. And it gives them the connections they need to be successful. Lots of times women are kind of left out for various reasons of old boys network, and this gives us our old girls network. It's inspiring. They're incredibly cool to go to.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I had a conversation with Maria Covey, and she talked about how she's been able to achieve into the 30s and 40% enrollment of young women into their programs. But she said a critical part of that was taking the young undergrads to the Grace Hopper Conference, and it made a big difference.
It does make a big difference, and every year I get, NSF has always given scholarships for students to go to this conference, and every year we get email and messages and letters from students who have gone to it and claim that it has just changed their life. And I also think that there are lots of times in when you're in a career that's very male-dominated and you're feeling a little bit isolated and uncomfortable, that you go to a meeting like this and it just completely changes your perspective. You go home, you're excited, you're energized, and you also have all these contacts. Maria, you mentioned her several times. Maria is an amazing advocate for women and an amazing advisor for women. An incredible number of women in the field have met Maria at these conferences and keep in touch with her and call her for advice all the time. And it's those kinds of networking opportunities that women have a hard time achieving in a field where they're such a minority.
You know, with your role with NSF, you're an internationally recognized authority with deep insights on diversity and education. So let's drill down further into this area. Can you provide background on the status of IT enrollments and why there is a need to increase interest?
So IT enrollments have been plummeting. The number of kids who show up at college saying that they're interested in majoring in computer science has dropped 70% since the year 2000 and 80% for women. So it's become quite significant. A lot of departments have lost huge numbers of students. Now, some departments at the top universities are seeing a turnaround now and are beginning to see kind of a little uptick in the number of students that are showing up. But overall, that number is still going down. So if you look at the data from students leaving high school, that the number interested in computing is still going down. At the same time, much of the projected job growth that we're supposed to have from the Bureau of Labor Statistics over the next decade will be in IT. If you look at STEM-related fields other than healthcare, in STEM-related fields, 61% of the job growth will be in IT. And for all those other jobs in STEM, you're going to need to have a pretty good computing background to do them. Almost computational problem-solving underlies almost all of the STEM fields now. So I think it's really important that we get back some of these students that we've lost. If you look at jobs in IT, they consistently make the list of the best jobs. Software engineering is a great job that has a lot of, it's very popular. They make also make the list of the jobs with the highest demand. So there are lots of companies out there that are looking. Google is looking to hire 1,600 people, and those are terrific jobs. So I think it's really important that we up the number of students that we're producing. This is a field that underlies much of our economy. It will underlie much of the problem solving that we do in really complicated situations. So much of the things that we're looking for in terms of solving healthcare, in terms of solving environmental issues, a lot of these solutions will be computationally driven.
You know, something that sort of comes to mind is there's confusion, though, in the sort of the terminology associated with computing. So, you know, I attended this educational conference recently or meeting, and you know, there's definitely sort of this segmentation of IT, which is separate from software engineering, which is separate from systems engineering, which is separate from information systems. And, you know, from, to the general public who are interested in sort of getting into IT and or into the computing, that it creates confusion. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, there is a lot of confusion. And even if you start looking at the definitions, they overlap, they're inconsistent. So there is a lot of confusion. I come from a computer science background, which is kind of the core of the theory behind computing and systems building. But computing is much more pervasive now. So you talk about IT. IT includes many more things. And it's hard to imagine where these definitions are, you know, how they're going to settle down, because there are a lot of definitions at the moment. But I think that I use the term computing to kind of encompass most of that. But you're right. I think that there is a problem with definitions, and that's confusing to the public.
Well, I think most people in the public domain think of IT as everything, right? You know, computer science, software engineering, systems engineering.
Yep. I think that's probably true.
So what
IT also includes a lot of media work, right, and a lot of business applications and media issues. I mean, there's a whole lot more that goes into kind of IT.
Now, what are the challenges in teaching computing in high schools, and how can this be best addressed?
Well, I'll talk just about the United States, because that's the country that I know the best, and because other countries differ widely. Many countries are having exactly the same problems that we're having in the United States, but many countries have kind of solved this and have great curriculum and great standards in computing. So if you look just at the United States, computing is just not taught in many high schools. It's not a math. It's not a science in most states, so it doesn't really fit in the curriculum anywhere. Much of the money to buy computers in the United States for high schools comes from Perkins money, and that money is directed all at career and technical education, which used to be called vocational education. And so there are courses in computing in most schools, but they're mostly literacy, very basic literacy. When we asked a couple hundred teachers to tell us what they were teaching, a lot of them listed keyboarding as a topic. Keyboarding isn't really an academic topic. And so many of these courses teach keyboarding. They teach how to use office products like Word and PowerPoint, and that's it. So they create students who are kind of literate, who can use computing, but they don't create students who can really understand computational problems, who can understand how computation is applied to problems, how to use computation, and how to kind of bend it to their needs. So it's one thing to use a program like Word, which is kind of a canned program where you just put in your data, but what about solving a real problem? What about environmental issues? What are you going to use there? How are you going to take existing software and combine it and compose it so that it solves the problem that you need? And is the problem that you need really something that could be solved with a computation, with computational approaches? What part of the problem is computational? So I think for all of those things, we do a very bad job of teaching students. In most states, there is no course, with the exception of it, perhaps the AP course, that counts for college credit in computing. Even the NCAA doesn't count computing as a college prep course anymore. So we're taking our best students, and we're not giving them any introduction to computer science at all. So when they get to college, they know what chemistry is, they know what biology is, they know what physics is. They have no idea what computer science is, so they tend to go with stuff that they know and not even give computer science a chance. So I've been working to change that. We have a project we call the CS10K, which is kind of our own private race to the top. We have this huge, a lot of money in the United States going into race to the top program, but computer science isn't really part of that because we're not currently in the standards that most students are held to. So we're not a math standard. We're not in the science standards. So the CS10K project looks at how to change this in the United States. Well, the United States education is completely decentralized. Even a school system like New York City school system, you can't go to a central office and say you should be teaching computer science because each principal can teach whatever they want in their school. And that's true pretty much across the United States. There's no point of national leverage where you can make a difference, except perhaps the AP course. So AP is taught in 17,000 high schools out of a total of about 23,000 public schools, and that's AP across the board. Only 7% of the high schools teach computing AP, but because they have a link to the AP program, it's much easier to get a course into schools that's an AP course, and college-bound kids can get credit for AP courses. So we're starting with a new AP course as the center of this project. Current AP course, for many reasons, is just not appealing to many kids. Many kids are not ready to take it when they get to it, and it's not very interesting. It doesn't tell them about, it's a programming course, entirely Java programming. It doesn't tell them about kind of, I hesitate to use the term magic because I've been trounced on that, people have trounced on that before, but kind of the amazing potential of computing, what you can do with it. When I started computing, was a long time ago, and we had these big black boxes, and they couldn't do anything unless you programmed them, and you were like empowered to think really big about what you could do with this and to create really interesting applications of technology. And we don't give the kids that feeling in the courses that we're teaching right now. So our hope is that the new AP course will, and it will come online, we hope, in 2015. And before that, we need to get 10,000 teachers prepared and ready to teach it and get it into 10,000 schools. So that's where the CS10K or the 10K comes from. And to do that, it's very difficult. Most states have standards that don't include computer science. They have very poor or no certification for computer science teachers. They don't give computer science credit as a college prep course in math or science. Many states don't even give it credit as an elective for college-bound students. We need to work with pre-service teachers. So We're looking at various programs like UTeach and other programs that produce a lot of teachers and trying to see if we can figure out how to link up better in terms of getting computer science students to take to become high school teachers. I taught for 25 years and I was married to, at the university level, and I was married to a high school teacher, and I never once told one of my students that they could take their computer science degree and become a high school teacher. And I never ever heard of anyone else ever telling any of their students that. So I think we really need to change as a community how we look at education, how we value education, and present those as opportunities to our students. We also need to look at all the teachers who are out there now who are teaching these basic literacy courses and give them the professional development that they'll need to teach courses at the AP level. So it's a pretty big project.
So, you know, you're talking about APs Advanced Placement, but in these programs, are you tying into things like Alice and Scratch and the Ensemble Initiative?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the new AP course is still under development. I think it is not going to be programming-centric. So the current course is Java, straight Java, and that course will continue to exist. But the course that we're looking at tries much harder to be engaging and tries to give kids more of a flavor of different languages and different things that you can do with computing. We haven't nailed down any language yet. But in addition to that course, many students are going to show up with no background whatsoever, and they're really not prepared to take an AP level, which is very rigorous. It's supposed to count as a college credit, so it has to be a very rigorous course. And many people will need introductory courses. And the introductory courses that we're looking at do use Alice and Scratch. They use a variety of different tools for teaching kids to program. Scratch, for example, and Alice, too. But I personally have worked more with Scratch because I've worked with younger kids in fifth grade. And in my fifth grade technology class, I really use Scratch a lot. And it's an amazing tool. It's free. You can download it off the web. And a kid can learn all of the concepts of programming in a very short time. And you don't even need to teach them necessarily. You just need to answer their questions. So they play with it for a while, and they come to you with a question that's essentially, how do you do a loop? Well, by that point, they already understand the concept of a loop and why they need a loop, and you can explain it and show them how to do it really easily. Within a couple hours, fifth graders are writing parallel processes that do signals and weights. It's a very powerful approach.
So how are women and minorities and people with disabilities represented in computing, and then what can be done to increase their representation?
Well, they're very poorly represented. As I said, they're 70% of the population. So there's no way we're going to meet our workforce numbers if we don't engage that part of the population. And so the program that I run really looks at how to do that. It's called Broadening Participation in Computing. And we run programs from middle school all the way through graduate faculty ranks. And we look at engaging students, coming up with ways to entice them into computing. So typically, kids faced with a programming course, like a Java programming course, that's not very enticing from the outside. Until you have some idea of the cool things you can do with computing, that's hard to swallow. But there are so many cool things that you can do with computing that it's easy to get kids engaged. You can use robotics. Pico crickets are great for girls who want to do kind of robotics, but it's more interactive art, so it's much more artistic. We have a project that looks at e-textiles, where you basically make your clothes do things, right? You have sensors and you have processors actually embedded in your clothes so that you can end jewelry that you can make with it. So it's a really appealing thing to many students. We have projects that look at linking journalism and linking art and linking media, coming at different applications of computing and getting kids really excited about what you can do with computing by engaging them through things they're already excited about. So I think that that's really important. I think it's really important to make sure that once they're engaged in computing, we have a good set of courses for them so that they can take that engagement and go further with it and develop it and get to the point where they really understand why they would want to take a Java course. And then I think we need to understand that there are issues for each of these underrepresented groups that we're going to have to deal with. So departments are going to have to become more savvy about how to deal with persons with disabilities. Students with disabilities are a great place for us to recruit from because of all the fields, we're the field that makes it possible to fully participate in many cases, even in face of severe disabilities. So there are many workarounds that will allow students with severe disabilities to be part of computing. And it's tough for the departments. Departments don't know how to deal with these students. They don't know how to help them. They might be uncomfortable. So we have efforts to change all that, to provide support, to get students fellowships, to get them hooked up with researchers so that they can get genuine experiences, and to support both the teachers and the institution and the students in these endeavors. For the other groups, each of them has their own set of issues, and so we need to look at why don't Hispanic girls, why aren't they interested in computing? If you look at the demographics from 13 to 17, we've done a study and found that Hispanic girls are very uninterested, almost totally uninterested in computing. Well, why is that? What messages have they gotten? Are there messages that are equally valid that they haven't gotten that would interest them? We've also found that African-American males in that age group are very interested in computing. Well, what happens to them? How come they don't show up on the other end of the pipeline and don't show up with these degrees? in a field that they claim to be very interested in. So I think there's lots of really interesting issues and lots of things that can be done.
What more can be done to increase participation in STEM disciplines?
Well, STEM disciplines are, of course, a very popular topic right now. A big focus of the education department's reforms are focused on STEM education. The president is very concerned about STEM education. So there's a lot that's going on. The one initiative that I'm most involved in is called National Lab Day. And it's a really horrible name. It has nothing to do with the national labs, although they're all participating. It has limited things to do with our normal concepts of labs, which are kind of, you know, bubbling beakers and scurrying beetles, that kind of thing. It's much more inclusive than that. It includes kind of anywhere that science and engineering and math could happen. And it's not a day. So the name National Lab Day is, it's not doing us any favors here. But what National Lab Day really is, it was modeled on Net Day. So Net Day started in the 90s, and that was to connect technical people with their schools in the hope that everyone would go into school for a day and wire up all the classrooms to the internet. And that was, you know, Net Day. And so that's where Lab Day grew out of. National Lab Day was supposed to be the same thing, except it was supposed to be national, and it was supposed to go into the schools and fix up labs and kind of get them in shape. And very quickly, it turned into much more than that. So right now, we have our goal is to connect teachers with a local community of support that involves volunteers who might be painting the lab or might be connecting it to the internet or might be cleaning it up, but who also might be doing a lot of other things. They might be chaperoning field trips. They might be arranging for job shadowing or mentoring students or tutoring students or working on science fairs with them. And we're particularly interested in getting STEM-based professionals, so scientists, engineers, technologists, mathematicians, into the classroom to work with the students. A lot of the data shows that students are turned off to math and science because their teachers are uncomfortable with it. I just read a bunch of reports the other day that first and second grade girls believe that math is hard for girls and not a good field for girls, and the correlation of those beliefs and their teachers being uncomfortable with math are very high. So I think what we want to do is get the people who are really comfortable with math and science, people who really love it and are enthusiastic and excited about it, to get those people in contact with the teachers. So we have a website, nationallabday.org, and you can go to that. And as a teacher, you can go and you can describe a project that you would like to see happen for your kids. And that project gets posted. And there's a map of all the projects that are posted around the country. And as a volunteer or as a scientist, you can go and you can sign up to help. And you can fill out a little profile. So I signed up as a scientist, and every 2 weeks or so, I get a little list of all the schools in my area that have asked for help in my field of expertise, the kind of help that I had volunteered to give. So it's a good way of connecting schools to teach to and their teachers to volunteers. There's 800 projects now that have been posted by teachers, and there's a couple thousand scientists who are responding to these projects. We hope to grow much bigger than that, to have 10,000 schools by the first week in May, and then to grow on, get on from there, and have all schools kind of routinely getting scientists and engineers and technicians into the classroom to do really exciting hands-on work with students. And of the projects that have been posted, 800 projects, so teachers could ask for anything. They could ask for money, they could ask for equipment, they could ask for someone to paint their walls. 95% of them ask for scientists and engineers to come into their classroom. So I think that it has a lot of potential for hooking kids up with people who can do hands-on stuff with them and get them real excited.
You know, there was Computer Science Education Week in December. Is that going to be an annual event?
Yes. So Computer Science Education Week was declared by Congress, and there was a very short time between when it was declared and when it happened. And there was a lot of publicity that went out around computer science, around the issues of computer science. There were videos made, there were broadcasts, there were papers written, there were things in newspapers, there were op-eds. So a whole lot of publicity went out, and we're hoping to capitalize on that. I think that it's important that we take our place, our rightful place in STEM. There is unfortunately no C in STEM, but computer science is part of it's a science. It's certainly technology. A lot of it is engineering, and a lot of it is supported by math and theory of computing. So I think it's everywhere in STEM. But because it doesn't have its own letter, it's ignored a lot. So I think Computer Science Education Week will help to focus legislative and academic attention on what's happening in the schools and how we need to change that. So I know there are plans already, involved in what we're going to do for next year to make it bigger and better and even more convincing.
Now, so we've talked about a lot of areas here. So what are the best resources for learning more about the issues we just discussed?
I think a great resource is the NCWIT. So NCWIT has an elaborate set of resources in its on its website. There's also, so that's if you're looking particularly for gender, but a lot for underrepresentation, a lot of education issues are discussed there. So I think it's a good first place. Another one is that there's a digital library on underrepresentation called bpcportal.org. So that portal has a lot of stuff on issues of underrepresentation, and it also has a link to the NSF BPC community, which is all the work that I've done and the PIs that have worked with me. So I have 150 people who we've supported, and their work is all described there. And finally, if you're interested in the idea of getting involved with schools, the National Lab Day website, which is just nationallabday.org, is terrific, has a huge resource section and really great resources there. There are incredibly cool things that you can do with kids, and these projects are already established. The materials you need, everything you need to do them is on that site in many places. There's also information on how to communicate effectively with kids, and it's a really good site. Now, that site is less mature than these other sites. It's growing and evolving pretty quickly. National Lab Day was announced by the president on November 23rd as part of his Educate to Innovate initiative, and it's been growing since then. So the resource section, it's not quite as organized and as easy to search as you might want, but there's still a lot there, and it's worth going to.
Well, we'll now leave this area to delve into other significant roles that you have. And first of all, then, what lessons can you share from your other roles and past experiences?
Well, I'm not sure that I have lessons for other people. So I think I have lessons for me. So the lesson for me, I think, that I've learned is that I'm really happiest when I'm involved in lots of different things. And I like to work on things that I see as part of some larger pictures. And the larger pictures that I care most about are education and equity issues. So I'm pretty interested in things that are leading in some path towards, you know, a larger goal of educational opportunities for everyone. I like to tackle things that are hard enough to require a lot of focus and concentration and hard work, but I burn out, and I need to be able to switch gears and do something else. So one of the greatest jobs that I had was being a faculty member, because you had research, you had teaching, and you had service roles, and these were three really distinct things, and you could switch between them. So it was really nice to be focused on research and then just to kind of burn out on what you were doing and not have any more good ideas and be able to switch for the rest of the day and go really focused on teaching and vice versa. So I like to do things. I'm happiest when I have lots of balls in the air and that most of those balls really, really matter to me. On the downside, I have some really low moments when it seems like I have lots of balls in the air and nothing's working, and that's pretty bad too. So, you know, what I've learned is to try and, for me, is to try and do lots of different things and to try and cover a lot of different territory without overloading myself.
You're quite engaged in the community through volunteer roles. Can you describe why you contribute and if others should engage?
Well, I have always really enjoyed being and working with kids. I find that to be really fun. And I find that to be a great outlet for this idea of having lots of things in the air and switching. So when I was a graduate student, it was, and as an undergraduate too, actually, you know, I would work really hard on subject that I was working on, you know, my classes and my research, and then it would be really great to go and just spend some time on a completely different topic working with kids. So I had brownie troops, I tutored kids, I was mentors for kids, and it was just such a nice change in pace. Same thing is true when I had my own kids. You know, you would work all day at work, and then you could come home, and you would be, like, in a completely different place, and it would really relieve all the stress and annoyances of the day, and you would be focused on your kids, and it was great. So I really have always enjoyed working with kids. I've tutored kids. I've mentored them. I've had brownie troops. I stopped pretty much doing that when my own kids were young because they were a handful enough. But after they got older and as they've left the house, we've done much more. I became a court-appointed advocate for a court-appointed special advocate called CASA. In some states, it's called a guardian ad litem for kids in the foster care system, because all my kids were adopted older. They were all older when we adopted them, and they all came through the foster care system. So I have become quite sympathetic to what happened to kids who were in that system and how horrible it is for many of them. So I've been an advocate for 12 kids over the last 11 years, and I still have one on my caseload. It's an incredibly interesting volunteer job because you stay with those kids for a long time. You stay with them from when they come into the system until when they leave the system, which is often years between when they first come into the system and all of the cases that I've worked on, because we work on the particularly difficult cases, parental rights have eventually been terminated and the kids have gone on to adoption. So that's a very long process. And you stay with the kids, you work with social workers, you work with parents, with foster parents, you work with their extended families, with schools, with their doctors, and with the courts, trying to figure out what's best for this kid and advocating for them. So again, it's kind of, there's a whole lot of different aspects of it for you to work on. And you also develop relationships with the kids. You see them several times a month. And because life in the foster care system is pretty chaotic and the kids move a lot, you become kind of a point of stability. You're the person that they've known the longest who has kind of stayed with them through this whole thing. And then in the end, though, the goal, of course, is to see them permanently placed in a safe home, and then you step back and kind of get out of their lives. So that, I think, is probably the most rewarding of the volunteer work that I've done. And I still have one young lady who is still on my caseload.
Well, that's quite remarkable. It's sort of your life is about contribution and impact, meaningful purpose, and lasting significance. And just amazed. What are some of the top lessons that you can share from the projects you've worked on?
I think similar to what I've already mentioned is this idea that I like to do things that contribute to something that matters. So I think you should pick things that contribute in some small way to something that matters. So if I tutor a kid, that's really not changing at the face of education across the country, but it is contributing in a small way. And so I try to pick projects that I think matter in some global scheme. Also, I think another lesson that I've learned is that I'm not going to have successes all the time. It's really hard to fix a kid's life who is in the foster care system and has been traumatized in many, many ways and has been bouncing around from house to house and takes 3 years to settle down. You can't fix all of that. So I think you go into most projects with the idea that you're going to get 10,000 teachers by 2015, or you're going to fix this kid's life and they're going to go on and everything will be smooth sailing for them. So I think kind of realizing that total successes are rare, and that you work towards big goals and then try and do the best you can and to get as much out of it as you can, get as much out of whatever you're trying to achieve. I've learned in terms of my professional life that it's much easier to garner support for really big ideas, big, bold ideas, than it is for small ideas. And most of all, I've learned that I need a huge network. So one of the real joys of the job that I have is that, or that I've had over the years, is that I come in contact with lots of people and meet lots of people and have built this just amazingly talented, creative group of people who I think of as my kind of own personal board of advisors, who I call upon all the time on all sorts of issues. One of the greatest things about working in Washington, D.C. is that all these people come through Washington all the time. So just last night I had a great dinner with a friend I've known for many years who's in town to go to some professional meeting. So I think that having this big network of people and having many of them become my closest friends has really kind of enriched my professional life and made me much more successful and much more able to do things.
You know, we're getting down to the last part of our interview. So what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Well, I think if you look around, especially being in Washington and hearing just all the political stuff all the time, when I first got here, I was told to stop using the word crisis because everybody used it every time you turned around. And in fact, it's true. Everybody is working on, you know, this crisis or that crisis, and they're real. We have huge problems as a country and as a planet to address. And I think our biggest challenge is to figure out how we're going to mobilize the talent and creativity of the world's population to solve those really big problems. And it seems to me that the only way we're going to do that is really through education. I think education is the key. We can't afford to leave people out because they don't have the opportunities to contribute. So I think we really need the help of a really enlightened group of people who are going to help us solve these problems. And those people are going to come from across the planet, but they're going to come through educational systems. So I think our biggest challenge is to figure out how to educate people. In the last century or so, you didn't need as much education as you need now. But if we're going to tackle these really big problems of healthcare and the environment and pollution and dependence on oil and all the other things that we're faced with, and security and terrorism, we're going to have some pretty creative people coming to the table with ideas.
If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I think these have been really great questions, and they've been really fun to answer and to think about. So I appreciate the opportunity. I don't know that I have any question that I would ask. The specific question that I would ask would probably be how to get involved, but I think I've answered that in various places already.
Well, I have just one more sort of comment and then question, and this is about the UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, and they have this professionalism program called IP3, where they're working on establishing IT as a profession worldwide. Do you have any comments about that program?
I think that's a great idea. So I would have to give the disclaimer that I have always been an academic, or I've worked in the government. I've never really been a professional IT person, so I've never been down in the trenches. But I think, as with any profession, you need to actually be recognized and be held to standards of professionals. I think that computing is certainly ubiquitous across society, and the standards to which computer scientists and IT professionals should be held are really high. And we depend on these programs for, you know, for life and death issues, to control planes, to control radiation machines, to control many things in our lives. And that dependence is going to grow as we get more robotics, as we get more and more technology entrenched in our everyday. So as the more important technology becomes to us, and the more ubiquitous it is, the more we're going to need to make sure that that technology is built and delivered to the highest standards. And I think that the idea of having professional standards for IT people is terrific and necessary. And, you know, it's very much like the same issues that we're having with teachers. You know, we need to have professional standards for teachers and have that work too. I think that these are things that we need in our society. And so I think it's a great idea.
Well, Jan, you know, we have come to the end of the interview, and considering your demanding schedule, we are very fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and I thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Jan Cooney, National Science Foundation Program Officer, award-winning research scientist. Jan shared her insights into increasing participation and attracting diversity into computing and STEM disciplines.